From Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning, Vermont. It is Tuesday, February the 18th, 2020, and we have a good show lined up for you this morning. We are going to be talking in the later hour of the program this morning with Jim Harvey. He is 89 years old, lives in Waterbury, and he has a long history as someone who's been a very big participant in horse racing here in Vermont, over in Saratoga, New York, and quite a career in horse trading, horse racing, and et cetera. And we're going to find out, we're going to maybe absorb some horse sense from 89-year-old Jim Harvey in the second hour of the program this morning. Looking forward to that. In the second half hour of the program, we are going to be visited by Ham Davis. He is a longtime writer on healthcare, a blogger on healthcare issues, and he is going to be filling us in on some of the recent trends and developments in Vermont healthcare. We're going to focus, I think, a fair amount on something called OneCare, which is this all-payer system for Vermont's healthcare system, and we're going to be finding out a little bit about what OneCare is and the likely impact that it is going to have as it sort of continues to develop in the coming years. So that'll be an interesting conversation as well. But first, I wanted to bring in a guest we've had on the show a few times before. Yesterday, John Margolis, political columnist with VT Digger, had a very interesting piece in that publication about the mainly about the sort of Democratic primary race, and went through all the various different candidates in the Democratic race and pointed out that there is more unity than difference between these Democratic candidates. Obviously, President Trump is kind of in the category by himself, the Republican incumbent president. But if whether the Democratic nominee ends up being Amy Klobuchar or Pete Buttigieg or Bernie Sanders or I guess Andrew Yang, not a possibility there anymore since he dropped out. But any one of Joe Biden, you name it, the Democratic governing strategy is going to be fairly similar, regardless of which of these candidates eventually emerges as the nominee. And assuming the nominee of the Democratic Party, let's say, went on to win in November, let's let John Margolis tell the story. John is with us this morning. Good morning, John.
Good morning. Happy to be here.
And yeah, I'm glad you're able to join us this morning. And I just thought, you know, I read this column by you, and I've had this sense from reading your stuff over time, actually, which is that, you know, here's a guy who's been around a long time. He's seen all the irrational exuberance out there pop up in various ways, and he's seen all the irrational consternation and whatever else kind of come and go in political contests. You were a reporter on politics for the Chicago Tribune, before that for Newsday. You've been to your share of New Hampshire primaries and Iowa caucuses and et cetera, et cetera, right?
I believe I was in New Hampshire primary night a week ago today. I believe it was the 10th one.
10th one. That. Wow.
The 10th and the last. I'm never going to do this again.
You've had enough.
I've had enough. But you said something interesting just now about how they all differ from Trump. Of course, and one party in policy and in the way they propose to lead the country, the two parties always differ. Sometimes not quite as such a polar manner as now, but they always differ, and that's really the big difference. And it's one reason parties are not bad things, and I'm somewhat puzzled by such a widespread dislike of partisanship. I mean, the partisanship in Washington has gotten nasty, but the problem there is not the partisanship, it's the nastiness and the narrow-mindedness. Following in general, you know, one wants to be, should be a slave to everything a political party may do, but parties are useful and valuable institutions. And you said they would have comparable strategies, the various Democratic candidates. They might have different strategies, but they wouldn't have such different outcomes, no matter who wins, because the most leftward, so-called progressive, Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, would probably propose things that are somewhat different from what President Buttigieg or President Klobuchar would propose, but they're not going to get everything through. And so what the life in America after 8 years of President Klobuchar would look almost the same as life in America would be after 8 years of President Sanders. They just, even if their proposals differed marginally, and I think the adverb is important there, but the outcomes would differ hardly at all.
Yeah, you know, and this is really fascinating to me because I think there is a lot of worry, frankly. I mean, I just saw a headline in one of the Vermont papers this morning about how worried sort of moderate mainstream Democrats are about Bernie Sanders being in the lead currently in the primary race, and that he might win Nevada, he might win California. If he wins California and a couple of other Super Tuesday states, he could be on his way to the nomination. And oh my word, this is so scary. And yet, you used a quote in your column from Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, which I was fascinated by this because she is, of course, a major backer, one of the big surrogates for Sanders out there on the campaign trail these days. And for those who don't know, she's a young first-term congresswoman from New York who has made a name for herself as quite a left-leaning Democrat. And she says about, this is talking about Medicare for All, the signature Sanders health care plan. And she says that she said Sanders is right to stick to his Medicare for All plan. She says the worst case scenario, we compromise deeply and we end up getting a public option. Is that a nightmare? I don't think so. And I just thought that's amazing. I mean, on one hand, I think to myself, there's somebody who may be compromising too soon. You know, we haven't even gotten to an election yet, and she's already kind of throwing at her cards, you know. But on the other hand, I think what she's showing there is that the this wild-eyed left maybe isn't quite as wild-eyed as a lot of people want to paint it being, right?
Well, it is not. And Bernie Sanders talks about creating a political revolution, but if you look at the specifics, what he proposes is not a revolution. It's a furtherance of the New Deal.
Mm-hmm.
It's robust social democracy, but no more robust than a lot of other capitalist democracies have, and no more than lots of American politicians have proposed on specific issues from time to time. What I think those Democrats you mentioned are really worried about, and this is not irrational, is that Bernie Sanders would lose very badly and drag House, Senate, governor, state legislative candidates with him. Now, I could spin a scenario, all this is fiction, nobody knows what's going to happen, in which Bernie Sanders wins the presidency,
mm-hmm.
or loses it narrowly, but also, I think more than any of the other likely Democratic contenders, he could get blown out. You could see Bernie Sanders losing 35 states. So I've talked this one. Democrats in Texas think they could be competitive with the right, probably not carry the state, but hold the congressional seats that they won in 2018, maybe pick up one or two more, maybe pick up a few seats in the legislature if their candidate gets 46-47% statewide.
Yep.
If their candidate gets 42% statewide, and they fear Bernie Sanders could get 42% statewide, then their hopes are dashed. So a moderate, and even, by the way, a lot of very, very left-of-center people are very much opposed to Bernie Sanders, partly on intellectual grounds, but also on these politically tactical grounds. These are people who are for raising taxes on the rich, doing something about climate change, having everybody covered by health care, all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But they are worried that a Sanders candidacy will be very bad. Although, as I say, you can also figure out a way that he wins, that he becomes president.
Yeah, I think that it is kind of, there is a bit of an idea of jumping off a diving board here.
He is the bigger risk. everybody's a risk. You know, mm-hmm. a 38-year-old who's never held a job bigger than mayor of a small to medium-sized city, a couple of women senators who most people are fairly unknown and easily painted as evil by the Trump campaign, a 77-year-old former vice president who seems spaced out part of the time. There's a risk with all of that. Certainly, a multi-billionaire who, with a mixed record on many sensitive issues, who is also too old. Arguably, I've said this before. I can say this because I'm their age. And I've covered the White House. President is a hard job. But so there's a risk to any of them. But you, on paper, you have to say the risk of a Sanders candidacy to the possibility of a Democratic debacle is greater.
Well, that may be a reason the party wants to shy away from him. And yet, I read this AP story in the Times Argus this morning, and they were talking about how so many Democrats are very, very nervous about Sanders, and they're nervous about his strength in California. And it did occur to me to wonder, has anybody sent a reporter out to California to ask voters out there, why is Bernie Sanders strong? What is it about him that seems to be attracting people? And, I mean, if he's strong in California, that's a fact that's probably worth, you know, peeling away a few layers of the onion. And what is it?
You're absolutely right. It's a good story. I can partly answer it. I can tentatively answer it. Mm-hmm. First place, California is a pretty liberal state.
Yep.
A lot of people who would be for him. Also, a couple things about Bernie Sanders, regardless of his policies, he is steadfast. People use the term authenticity. You know, in a way that a lot of people who didn't agree with Ronald Reagan voted for him because you knew where he stood. There was no nothing fraudulent, nothing sneaky about him. There is a little bit, as there was with Reagan. But so do we all. I mean, they're all human beings, and nobody's 100% candid. But Bernie Sanders is pretty close for a leading politician. You know what to expect from him, and voters like that. Voters like people who are steady and very little mystery about them. So that, and you know, Hillary Clinton said nobody likes him, meaning in the Senate. A lot of voters like someone who is not so much liked by the powerful, because people feel that they have been forgotten by the powerful. And Bernie Sanders sincerely and legitimately sends the message: I care for those of you who've been forgotten by the powerful in both government and in the private sector, and that message comes across. So I think now the problem with Sanders is, does he have a ceiling? This new poll this morning had it above 30 for the first time, 31,
mm-hmm.
I believe, and that's a good poll. Marist is a good polling firm. So maybe his ceiling is not as low as some people, including me, had thought. He had not gone above 25. And, you know, he won the New Hampshire primary with 26.
Yeah.
Which means that 75% of people voted for somebody else. So, 74. But now he's over 30, and it's not like Trump, who people thought he had a ceiling, and he didn't have such a ceiling in the Republican Party. Sanders stacks up well in polling one-on-one against the other contenders and against Trump. That nobody should take that as a prediction. But I don't know whether his ceiling is all that low.
Yeah, one thing that I wonder about with Sanders is that if you look at his sort of electoral record in Vermont, he's done surprisingly well, better than I think just a casual observer would expect in pretty conservative parts of the state. And
indeed.
And he's been able to pick up, you know, working class, blue collar, rural voters in the Northeast Kingdom to a much greater degree than I think, you know, kind of the first blush of looking at the national political picture would tell you. And I wonder if there's any talking to the nervous Democrats by him or by his people, where they could say, look, you know, it's not as bad as you think. We could actually maybe make some inroads into the folks who supported Trump in 2016. And the story could unfold as follows. You remember Hillary Clinton made her famous speeches at Goldman Sachs for six-figure speaking fees and then refused to release the transcripts or copies of the speeches or whatever, right?
Yes.
I think that was one of the most damaging things that she did or that happened to her or some combination thereof.
You are correct. I believe you're correct.
Throughout the because what it really said was, you know, if the whole discussion is about the 1% versus the 99%, she is clearly taking sides there and is telling the 99% that you're not even allowed to know what we talk about when the doors close. And I think that really, that kind of an attitude really put a lot of people off, frankly.
Indeed, I think you're 100% correct.
And so Trump comes in, who is a genuine member of the 1%. You know, he's either a billionaire or wants to be or lies about being a billionaire or whatever it is. And he is somebody, you know, famously sort of plutocratic and gaudy about his wealth and so on and so forth. And here he comes and he says, I'm going to represent the little person whose aspiration, after all, is to be like me. And he wins. And I really do think that was a huge dynamic in the 2016 race. And so now you have another candidate come along in Bernie Sanders who says, you know, not only am I representing the 99% and I come from a lower middle class background and et cetera, et cetera. But I'm not lying about it. I'm the real deal, right?
I think that's you're absolutely correct. And whether the Sanders people, to my knowledge, are not making that argument very well. Maybe they're not making it at all, and that's why we haven't heard it. Maybe they're making it quietly, but I think they should push it harder. Now, I used to live in the Northeast Kingdom, as you know. One of the reasons he did well there early on was he was a little soft on gun control.
Yep.
And that helped him there in the beginning. He doesn't want anybody to talk about that. And it's a long time ago, and he's not that way anymore. But he also Veterans Affairs. Although he's not served in the military himself, he was very strong on veterans benefits and helping veterans. And we're talking about a population in which a lot of people have gone into the service, and their children still go into the service.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was helpful. Also, as you say, he's a down-to-earth guy, not very fancy about him. Too many of his followers are not such down-to-earth guys. One of the problems Bernie Sanders has is this, not very much from him. There's a kind of a humorless self-righteousness around his staff, his supporters, and many of just his rank-and-file people.
I do have to mention Bernie Sanders' age and health. How big are these concerns?
Well, right now they don't seem to be a concern, but it's interesting that he is refusing to reveal any more information about his health. He's revealed some, not as much as some of the other candidates. I'm thinking, actually, writing about this, it's an interesting history. There's no requirement. And there should be some, we don't have to know everything about a potential president's physical condition, but there are objective criteria. We should be able to know, the public should be able to know how likely he is, A, to survive, to be healthy, to avoid dementia. He is 78 years old.
Mm-hmm.
He has had a heart attack. It would probably be good, I don't know whether it would be good politically, but it would probably be good just as a question of good policy and good government for him to release more information. Warren has released more. Now, he's not the first one.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, in 2016, Hillary Clinton, after she had sort of stumbled and almost fainted because it turned out she had not told people she'd had pneumonia, which she should have, she then released quite a lot of information and revealing that she was, in fact, a healthy person. Obama released a lot of information. Bill Clinton did not when he first ran. John McCain released 7,000 pages. At that time, he was the oldest person ever to run for president. He was, I believe, 71. He'd been a prisoner of war for years. He had all those questions about his health. So he was very candid, very forthcoming. Bernie Sanders has not been. He has said he's not going to release anymore. He said, well, then where does it stop? But there are, as I said, and I don't have them in my head now, objective criteria taken from what insurance companies ask, the information that they demand, say, before they insure an older person. So there are certain questions that physicians and doctors can ask. Dr. Altman, who's also, or at least was, a reporter for the New York Times, has some ideas on this. And Bernie Sanders has not yet, and says he's not going to, release that much information.
Yeah, I'm torn about this because I have a fair degree of sympathy for the idea of medical privacy and just, you know,
yeah,
this
absolutely
is some of the most intimate details about a person's life.
Right, we didn't have to know about Jimmy Carter's hemorrhoid, really, but
yeah.
That doesn't threaten your capacity.
Hey, John, I'm afraid that's about all the time we have this morning.
Fine.
I really appreciate you checking in with us and giving us your thoughts. Appreciate it. Let's do this again soon. Going to take a brief break here for some CBS News at the bottom of the hour and more of the Dave Graham Show to follow. Stay with us, folks.
As the winter rolls on, we're on sale upstairs at the Warren Store. All fall winter clothing is 20 and 25% off. Cozy tops, comfy bottoms, warm coats and jackets for men and women. Cool, Prana, Smartwool, Save the Duck, Kari Tra long underwear. Need a hat? We have Skeeta, Shukas, Papia, and more. Palms and beanies galore. And a large selection of socks from fun to functional, Blue Q to darn tough. Spring clothing is arriving, so come on down for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. The almost world-famous Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM.
A lot of noise in there.
We are back, and I want to introduce my next guest, who is Ham Davis. Hamilton Davis is a longtime journalist. He had worked at the Burlington Free Press, the Providence Journal, won a Peabody Award, I think it was, when he was doing healthcare coverage for Channel 3 WCAX back in the day. And he's been around healthcare issues and journalism for quite a number of years. And Ham, I've been meaning to bring you onto the show because I've been trying to get a really better understanding than I have, and frankly, than I think a lot of our listeners have, of this thing that we keep hearing and reading about called OneCare, which is this all-payer system here in Vermont. And I want to find out, just get a little primer here, if we could, for starters, and find out from you, what the heck is OneCare?
Well, I think I think you're right, Dave. There's a lot of misunderstanding about that. And I hope I have enough time. Let me just tell you a tiny story, okay? Do you remember? Mm-hmm. Do you know Dick McCormick?
Yes.
Okay.
State senator from Windsor County.
Yeah, and I thought it was Orange, but you know better than I do.
Okay.
In any event, about 7 or 8 years ago, Dick McCormick fell down a flight of stairs, broke his arm.
I remember that.
And he was in Springfield at the time, but then he went back to his primary care doctor in Bethel, where he lives, and that doctor sent him to Dartmouth-Hitchcock to get his arm fixed.
Yep.
They worked on his arm for about 6 months at Dartmouth-Hitchcock, but it didn't work. It was not getting better. It was really badly broken.
Hmm.
And so they sent him to Gifford Hospital, where an orthopedic surgeon put in a bone graft to try and get the job done.
Mm-hmm.
2 weeks later, the bone graft fell out. He went back to his primary care doctor, and they sent him to Alice Peg Day, which is a small community hospital sitting right next to Dartmouth, just across the river in New Hampshire.
Mm-hmm.
They worked on him for a while, and they couldn't figure it out. So he finally went to UVM, okay, where after about a year and a half, they did a wild thing to fix his arm. It was a Rube Goldberg contraption so that Dick himself could force, gizmo on his arm, could force the bones in his arm back together. It finally worked.
Wow.
Okay?
Yeah.
The whole cost of that was about $300,000.
Yikes.
Okay?
Yeah.
Okay, that's $300,000 for one arm. That's a lot.
Yeah.
Okay, and
yeah.
Unless you can get something like that under control, then you can't solve the problem of health of cost containment either here in Vermont or in the United States. Hence, you need something else. So if you draw a picture, if you just take a pencil, draw a line around those all those different hospitals and doctor units that took care of Dick's arm.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and say we're going to put those guys all in one box. We're going to put them together in sort of a group or a co-op or something. We're going to call it that, and we're going to pay that co-op $90,000 max to fix that arm.
Mm.
It's their responsibility to fix it. Okay, if they can't fix it, what they're going to get to fix it is a fixed price, $90,000 to fix Dick McCormick's arm.
Yeah.
The thing that you have to do, that co-op, is something that you call an Accountable Care Act, and that's what One Care is. It's just a way to put all the hospitals and all the providers in a box, okay, so that you can get the health care you need delivered to the people in your area for a fixed price that people can afford. That is what an ACO is. It's the only way you can do it. It's been established by the federal government, and One Care is nothing more than a box, okay, that runs the money to healthcare through the box in order to get fixed price contracts.
Here's an analogy I've heard, to the public education system. Right now, you take a school district or a town or whatever, you draw the boundary around the area. The job is to say, we're going to educate every kid in the district. And some of the kids are going to show up who are really strong in math, and other kids who are going to show up who are really weak in math. And it doesn't really matter how many times the kid has to get this certain lesson in algebra. The point is to try to eventually educate every kid to a certain proficiency in algebra. And if you were going to go to the old healthcare fee for service model in our education system, basically every time the kid went to algebra class, there would be a fee generated.
Right. That's right.
But this is a sort of a universal school budget, which says, you know, here's the school building, here's the staff of teachers.
Here's what it costs.
Working in the school building. Here's what the whole system costs. So we're going to pass our annual school budget. And yes, costs rise sometimes. People complain about their property taxes. That's an old story. But at least we sort of have a handle on what the overall costs are going to be. Whereas if you were going to charge every time a kid had to go back for another dose of A plus B times A minus B in algebra, then you'd really have no idea what you're going to end up paying.
Well, I haven't heard that analogy before, Dave, but I'm stealing it.
Okay.
I agree with that. That's what you're trying to do is what the whole Vermont reform system is trying to do is rejigger the system so that you can get the costs in a position that we can keep paying it year in and year out, and it's not there now. We paid in 1966 when the federal and state governments got involved in healthcare financing. We paid 6.6% of our gross state product for healthcare. We're up to 20. And if that doesn't slow down, then all the money we make will have to go to healthcare.
And that actually is one of the things that always has bothered me about the healthcare system overall, which is that it seems to be in some ways, you know, people talk about all the great jobs available to people who work in healthcare and how, you know, many, many people who work in this area can make a good living, and it's a glorious thing if your community has a really good hospital or a couple of really good hospitals or whatever the case may be. And yet, in some ways, it's a giant subtraction. You know, who was it, the guy from Texas there, the billionaire ran for H. Ross Perot.
Oh, yeah.
Name almost slipped me, but H. Ross Perot used to talk about that giant sucking sound.
About Mexico.
And my question is that some of what we're looking at with healthcare, where it kind of drains money from the kind of productive economy where you were actually going to be building things and I don't know, creating new stuff or whatever?
Well, I don't think there's any doubt about that, Dave. The one of the number you don't hear much anymore, but for 25, 30 years, which is how long I've been action watching at 40, it was well a cliche for quite a long while that the single greatest input cost that General Motors had building automobiles was paying for health care insurance for their employees. Biggest single cost, more than steel, glass, all kinds of the inputs that you have to get, the complex thing like an automobile. Most important single price was for healthcare.
Now, this is going to sound like a little bit maybe too deep or whatever. We're going deep state here, folks, as in six feet deep. But healthcare always fails in the end, right?
Yeah, right. I can assert without any fear of contradiction that the death rate for humans is holding steady at 100.
100%. So, I don't know. It's kind of disturbing when you think about, with all the money that gets spent and all the honor and glory that go to the people who are our practitioners. And a lot of them are really brilliant and dedicated and work incredibly long, hard hours and all that sort of thing. But, if somebody were to kind of look down at this whole thing from outer space somewhere and say, what is this species doing?
Well, a lot of people, I agree with that. And there's no question that it's known by everybody that the healthcare costs per individual go up dramatically the older they get, and you get a huge metric like the last year of life. Then you're spending more in the last year of life than you did in the whole life up to that point. That's just a hard thing. On the other hand, man, you get a carload of teenagers hit a tree in the on the way home from the prom, and mm-hmm. Let me just tell you, your kids, you want a real piece of health care, and it's not just kids.
Yeah.
I mean, I had, when I was 65, I had a quadruple bypass heart operation. Mm-hmm. I'd be long gone if it wasn't for that, and I think people desperately need me now, don't you, Dave?
I do. I actually am. I'm glad that whatever my insurance rates went up that year to help pay for that, I'm happy to pay it.
It wasn't cheap, Dave.
I understand. And I mean, there is an upside here, I will say. Here's something that my mom has said to me from time to time. Both of her parents died in their 50s of heart disease, back in the 50s or roughly, early 60s, whatever. And she's now 90. And she says that the big difference there is that, there are all these meds out now which weren't around back then. You think about all these, the statins and the blood pressure medications and et cetera, et cetera. It's just kind of amazing when you think about the changes we've seen in healthcare and then the longevity within this one family, which happens to be mine. So.
No, I understand. There's no question that the healthcare is both a miracle and a huge problem. It does wonderful things. It does terrible things. It makes huge mistakes. It has all kinds of problems attendant on it. But absolutely, there's no way we're going to get along without it.
What is it, a human endeavor or something? We got a caller on the line, Paul from Moncton. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning, Dave, and good morning to your guests. Hey, I heard just a few minutes ago a comment made, and I'm just trying to wrap my brain around that because I don't understand that much about this new possible program. And that is this. You mentioned that in 1966, when the federal and state governments took over or got involved with the healthcare, we went from 6% of our income yearly to 20%. So if this new plan has anything to do with more government control, doesn't that run counter to your plan of actually making it more affordable? Since 66, government control took over, it skyrocketed?
What do you think, Ham Davis?
I'm not sure I quite understood that. I can't hear that well.
Let me see if I can summarize here.
Okay, go ahead.
I think the question really is.
It's not Paul's fault. That's you're talking an old guy, Paul.
Yeah. Government. You were talking about how healthcare had gone from 6% of our economy to 20% of our economy since 1966.
Yeah.
And that over that time, government has become much more involved in healthcare, Medicare, et cetera. And Paul is questioning, I think really his question goes to, when we hear about things like Medicare for All or even more government involvement in delivery of healthcare, aren't we looking at just a huge increase in the amount of our economy that gets bitten off by healthcare?
Well, I don't think that's the reason, but there's no question that 20% is a lot. What we'd really need is probably somewhere between 6 and 20, and probably 8 to 10 would probably make a lot more sense. One of the things that's a factor is that we've tried all kinds of ways, beginning in the 1970s. We had rate setting. We had PROs. We had PPROs. We had all kinds of regulation. Nothing has slowed this juggernaut down, okay, until really now in this state. We have the inflation rate in the hospital system, just the hospital system, in the aughts from 2000 to 2009, the average increase per year was over 8%. Even in the early stages, we're only at the early stages of reform in Vermont, but the regulatory system, which includes the Green Mountain Care Board on regulation, One Care Vermont in starting to move towards fixed price contracts, and so forth, the inflation rate now is just under 4%, so that the regulatory effort so far, which has not yet matured and has not reached its full scope, has cut inflation rate in the medical healthcare inflation rate in Vermont by in half. And if you compound that number, the actual number of the savings between 2013 and 2020, the total savings, money that Vermonters did not have to spend, is $2 billion. I think that's pretty good.
$2 billion in savings, I would take it. That would keep me healthy for a couple of weeks. What is the name of your blog, and where do people find it?
The name of it is you have to have the A, Vermont Journal. You can get it at avermontjournal.com, and you can subscribe, which means that I don't post a lot. But if you subscribe, there's the monkey chimp or the chimp something or other.
MailChimp, I think it is.
The MailChimp. Yeah. They will send it right to your email, and you don't have to waste your time the rest of the time. Anyway, that's what it is.
The monkey chimp. That sounds like some kind of crossbreeding.
I just call him the monkey. I have a managing editor who does all of that, and I have no idea how to do it.
All right. Hey, we have a caller on the line. Let's go to Ruth in Sheldon. Good morning, Ruth.
Good morning. Healthcare costs have risen faster than inflation for decades. And there's no legitimate reason for that. Healthcare costs should not rise faster than inflation. You are wrong when you say 3.5% is, and you said 4% reduction in healthcare costs is good. You're wrong, because our healthcare costs in Vermont are the highest in the nation. We should be cutting what our healthcare costs, not letting it rise 3.5%.
Okay, Ruth, thank you for the call. I appreciate that. Ham Davis, what do you make of this?
I agree with you, Ruth. The whole goal here is to make the thing affordable, and we've gone, as you say, and you're absolutely right about that, that we've been running at 3, 4, 5, sometimes 6 times the underlying rate of inflation in the economy, increase in healthcare since I've been involved in it, which started in 1980. So, and that's what has made it go up. That the question is not whether it should that healthcare costs should not exceed the growth in the overall inflation rate in the economy. I agree with that. The question is how to do it. If you think that's easy, I don't agree with you about that, Ruth. It's really, really, really hard, and it's going to get harder. Okay, so but your basic point is, should it happen? Absolutely. My question to you is, how do you want to do it?
Yeah, you know, I think that is, we're kind of at the beginning stages here of a problem in which basically a lot of our population is aging, and when people get old, they tend to need more healthcare.
Right. They even have sometimes hard time hearing, like I am right now. So, the absolutely this is a hard. I've worked on as a journalist since 1962, in all kinds of places, all kinds of ways, and I've covered virtually every major issue faced. I've never in my life, in my professional life, dealt with an issue that's as complex and gnarly and nasty as trying to get at health care costs.
Let's go to Fred in Newbury. Good morning, Fred.
Morning. Hey, it's very interesting because right now my health care, I got, what do they call it, Medicare, and it's managed through United Healthcare, and it costs me whatever Medicare, the Part B, Part A, I pay that. And then I pay United Healthcare an extra $60 a month for the health care, which is basically a catastrophic health care program. But my long-term health care insurance bill is $2,500 a year. Nobody's talking about it. It's crazy. $2,500. And I bought the policy. I bought the policy when I was 62. So I'm 77 now. So you do the arithmetic.
15 years.
Then it was cheap 15 years ago. Today, Dave, you call up an insurance company and see how much you're going to have to pay for it because, what are you, 60? You won't be able to afford the policy.
I bet you're right.
That's Paul. You said
Fred from Newbury.
I mean Fred, I'm sorry.
Yep, yep.
Fred, I'm paying the same stuff. I pay United Healthcare for the Delta, the overage, and I have Medicare, and it's no question that the costs on individuals, in spite of the all kinds of supplementary or subsidy problems, the cost is plain too high. It's not affordable. The question is how to get it affordable. And I can just tell you this: it's not there yet. I'm not saying it is, and I don't know anybody that's saying it is. But here's what I would say: the state of Vermont is closer than anybody else because the providers are all in, and the Vermont legislature, in the bill that it passed in 2011, Act 48, has given the regulatory system unprecedented power, and so the combination of those two things has got to get it done. It's getting it. It's moving forward. It is. There are no bad numbers out there yet, but the job is not done.
Your problem is this. You're not telling me how much your long-term health care policy is.
If you separate long-term care policies from acute care, which is if you break a leg, then that's acute care. If you have to go to a nursing home, that's long-term care.
Right.
We have no answer yet for long-term care. We just don't. We're trying to get acute care under control. It's not like long-term care is cheap. It's not like long-term care is affordable. But long-term care costs are not rising anywhere near as fast as acute care costs are in places like hospitals. So we don't, there's private insurance out there for long-term care. I don't believe in any of it.
Ham Davis, I have to say we are at the top of the hour here, about the end of our segment, and boy, it flies by, I'll tell you. We could talk about this for hours, I guess, but anyway, thank you very much for coming in this morning. Really appreciate it.
Okay, nice to talk to you, Dave.
And we are going to go to some CBS News at the top of the hour, a couple of words from our sponsors, back with more of the Dave Graham Show in just a couple of minutes, folks.
As the winter rolls on, we're on sale upstairs at the Warren Store. All fall winter clothing is 20 and 25% off. Cozy tops, comfy bottoms, warm coats and jackets for men and women. Cool, Prana, Smartwool, Save the Duck, Kari Tra long underwear. Need a hat? We have Skeeta, Shukas, Papia, and more. Palms and beanies galore. And a large selection of socks from fun to functional, blue cue to darn tough. Spring clothing is arriving, so come on down for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. The almost world-famous Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village.
News Radio WDEV FM and AM. Now back to the Dave Graham Show.
Back, continuing into our second hour on this Tuesday morning, the 18th of February 2020, and so glad to have folks out there continuing to listen in here to the Dave Graham Show. One of the things I always like to mention is our podcast. In case you miss parts of the show or the whole show, you can always tune in by checking out WDEVradio.com. That's the homepage of the station. Follow the link from there to the Dave Graham Show. Scroll down a little bit. You'll come up with a list of our recent programs by topic and guest and be able to zero in on what you want to hear any time of day or night. And we thank the Warren Store, the friendly, funky, and almost world-famous Warren Store for sponsoring our podcast. All right, I do believe we have CBS's Steve Dorsey on the phone with us this morning to talk about some of the latest doings on the national scene. Good morning, Steve.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning, and tell me about John Bolton's appearance at Duke University last night.
Well, it was, you know, the first time we've really heard him speak out since this controversy erupted with his book that apparently the New York Times got its hands on, a manuscript version of it. And in it, Democrats and New York Times say that it included accusations that the president wanted to continue withholding hundreds of dollars in aid for Ukraine to get the country to announce investigations into his political opponents like Joe Biden.
Yeah, that was sort of interesting development right at the smack dab in the middle of these impeachment proceedings where no new facts were alleged, but there was more support, it seemed, given to, you know, one of the early counterpunches from the Republicans was that you didn't have enough sort of firsthand accounts of the alleged demand by the president of the United States for dirt on the Bidens in exchange for these hundreds of millions of dollars in military aid. And along comes John Bolton's book, Biden Bolton. There's confusing the heck out of me. Anyway, John Bolton's book saying that, yeah, I was on the scene and the president, in fact, did talk about a quid pro quo and a demand of Ukraine that it deliver dirt on the Bidens in exchange for getting this military aid. And that sort of created a few days of excitement and so on from the Democrats, including a widespread demand that Mr. Bolton and perhaps others be called in to testify in the Senate impeachment trial. Of course, that ended up not happening, and the president ended up being acquitted. And it seems like all of that is ancient history. What was it, a couple of weeks ago?
Yeah, and that time flies, right?
Yeah, that is for sure. So,
I mean, Democrats have wanted to get their hands on this book. They tried to subpoena it. They tried to subpoena John Bolton himself, but that was all shot down by the Republican-controlled Senate. Still, we're waiting to see if this book is published at Duke. Bolton said he hopes the White House doesn't suppress it, and apparently it's still undergoing a review process after the White House told him that it contained classified information in it.
Well, one thing I'm curious about is there a serious threat there that the White House will pretty much put the kibosh on the whole book, or will it just have to be rewritten in spots, or what's the deal there?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a key question and a key matter for the publisher too. They're going to defend John Bolton and his work as the former national security advisor. And it's just surreal also to see how much the two have fallen out, Mr. Trump and Mr. Bolton. They were close, they were allies, and then they started disagreeing over key issues like Iran, and now the president has been lashing out at him on Twitter. Bolton told that crowd last night in Duke that he hopes he can respond to the president's criticisms of him.
Well, and also, I mean, the thing with Bolton is that you have to wonder whether there will be at least a temptation for the White House. The White House, under federal law, from what I understand, and tell me if this is wrong, but I think the White House has the authority to demand that certain passages in the book not be published on the grounds of national security. We've got to preserve our secrets. And, of course, John Bolton, as the former national security advisor, is going to be in possession of some, I'm sure, secret information that probably shouldn't get out. And so then the question becomes, where do you draw the boundary between information that genuinely shouldn't get out and information which the president doesn't want to get out because it may not be all that positive for him politically?
And the White House could argue that there is reason to classify information that might not seem obvious, and that's something that they'll probably do with this book as well.
Yeah, you know, I mean, if in fact there is this argument out there now that reelecting the president isn't the public good of the country, which is kind of a novel legal argument that came up during the impeachment proceeding, I suppose by extension you could imagine the White House saying that our national security demands that the president be reelected, and therefore anything that is politically damaging to him is damaging to our national security. I mean, how far does this go?
You know, it could go to court. I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah, yeah.
That could cause more problems for the president, especially if there's discovery and stuff like that. But, you know, this is a story that we probably won't see the last of.
I had earlier on heard a publication date for the John Bolton book of March 17th, St. Patrick's Day. And I wonder, are we still expecting it to be in bookstores roughly thereabouts, or is it going to be delayed for some time?
I think we had heard that as like a placeholder date. I don't imagine there's really much of a way to get this all done, reviewed, and printed and in bookstores in just a month. You know, folks haven't even reviewed it yet. I wouldn't say that's a likely outcome that we'll see so soon, but perhaps it could be later down the line.
Yeah, and of course, who knows? I mean, I wonder if it could be delayed right past Election Day. You never know. That would be...
It'd probably be best for the president, and maybe that's a compromise that worked out with Bolton.
Yeah, for sure. And I suppose the former National Security Advisor, John Bolton, then... you know, he's got his own sort of reputation and credibility and so on to defend here. So I would think that his temptations are not going to be necessarily to be as nasty in this book as part of it might want to be. I guess I don't know if I'm expressing that properly, but I think people ought to put a fair amount of credence in this book to some extent, because there is this, I'm sure he has an interest in trying to come across as someone who is, for instance, could have a job in a future administration.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially if it's a Republican, obviously, not much chance. I think if it's a Democrat, especially this crowd of Democrats right now for office.
Yeah.
But certainly he's thinking about his own career future.
Sure. Well, Steve Dorsey, I thank you as always for joining us here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM, and I hope you have a good day. We'll talk to you soon.
Hey, thank you.
Wanted to mention that one of the things I'm hoping to do with the show as 2020 continues to unfold is just occasionally invite interesting community members, residents of our Central Vermont area, the WDEV listening area, onto the show to talk about some of the fascinating stuff people do with their lives around here. It's a great area for people's personal stories and kind of how you get by in terms of making a living in Vermont and in terms of the interesting hobbies and other activities people engage in around here. I thought a good place to start would be right here in Waterbury, in the Waterbury-Duxbury area, our own neighborhood here. Of course, WDEV's been on Stowe Street here for a long, long time here in Waterbury. And one of our neighbors right across the river is the Harvey Farm. Been there about 100 years, I do believe.
102.
102 years. And Jim Harvey is a major player in the activities over there at the Harvey Farm, and has been a major player in the activities of Vermont's horse racing and horse trading and horse just in general industry, etc., over decades, and joins me this morning to tell us a little bit about that and about the continuing interest folks here in Vermont have in their horses. And Jim Harvey, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Happy to be here.
And by the way, we also welcome calls from our listeners out there. Anybody has comments or questions about, especially about horses in Vermont over the next little bit, we're going to be talking about on the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV. Welcome to call 244-1777 and check in with us here. I'm not a horse expert myself, but I'm hoping to learn some stuff in the next few minutes here on the Dave Graham Show. on WDEV. Jim Harvey, you are now, I'm told, 89 years old. Is that correct?
I'm afraid so, yes.
Well, it beats the alternative, I hear.
Right.
That's what they say anyway.
That's what they tell
me. And you're looking good. You're trim. You seem fit. And I understand I'm gonna talk up a little bit because I hear your hearing may not be all that it used to be.
I can hear you okay with these.
Excellent. No, that's good. You got the headphones on, and as I do, and that's the normal life in radio here, folks. So, Jim Harvey, you I gather have been a lifelong resident of the Waterbury-Duxbury area,
yeah,
right?
I was born on the farm,
and the farm is actually in Duxbury, right?
It's in Duxbury, yes.
Across the river,
just across the river from the north end of Waterbury.
How many acres do you have over there?
Oh, originally about 350.
Mm-hmm.
And somewhat less now.
I see. Okay. And the Harvey farm you were grew up milking cows over there. I'm thinking
it was a dairy farm. Also, my father bought and sold draft horses at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So we had those to contend with as well.
I see. So you're out milking the cows in the morning, then you got to go muck out stalls.
No, I sold them. Ended that in 1968.
Uh-huh, yeah. And but when you were a kid, you had to deal with both horses and cows every day.
Yeah, we had anywhere from 6 to 25 draft horses for sale at a time.
Wow. And what are the breeds? What's the breed?
They were usually Belgian horses. They're raised in Canada and the Western provinces all the way to some of them as far away as Alberta.
Wow.
They're shipped into Montreal.
And
sold there.
They'd be brought in on train, and you'd go up to Montreal to buy them?
My father would go to Montreal to buy them.
Mm-hmm.
He'd buy 7 for a truckload or 18 or 20 for a carload and a railroad car.
I see. And what was it like getting through customs and bringing horses back into the United States?
At that time, I never was involved in that part of it at
yeah,
the
okay.
time.
Okay.
Right now, you have to have a blood test, et cetera, et cetera.
Wow, huh. Yeah, I know they've gotten more careful over time with trying to avoid spread of diseases and that sort of thing. And
that's for certain.
Yeah. Now, are you still bringing in horses from Canada occasionally?
No, I'm. Last horses I purchased, in Delaware.
From Delaware, okay. And are you still in the horse trading business then? Are you still?
I still have one racing, yes. He raced last fall at Saratoga, but he had a problem with the ulcer, so we had to shut him down for a time.
Hmm.
But he did get 9 starts, and he had 3 wins, 3 seconds, and a third.
That's a pretty good record.
So he's kind of a nice horse.
Let me try to remember. Is it Kelly's Noah?
No, his name is Yachtsman.
Oh, Yachtsman, okay.
Noah is retired.
I see, okay. Kelly's Noah was a winner too, right?
He was my top horse ever, yes. I bought his mother at a farm in Quebec, and she was a nice race mare. So I raised foals for her for several years, and he was like number 5 of the group. And from day one, he was a good horse.
He's
developed into the fast. He's got the fastest speed record, the most money won of any horse ever raised in Vermont.
Wow. This is Kelly's Noah, you mean?
Kelly's Noah, yeah.
Yeah. And what was his career? When was he active or racing?
He retired 2 years ago.
Okay. So, and how long do they usually last from the time they start racing?
Well, he raced till he was 11, but usually 8, 9, 10, 11, long in there.
Yeah. I remember years ago, I grew up down in the Boston area, and this is back in the 70s, and there was a famous racehorse named Secretariat. You probably remember, won the Triple Crown.
Running horse, yeah. Thoroughbred.
A thoroughbred racehorse. And there was a terrific sports writer for the Boston Globe named Ray Fitzgerald, and he had this funny line in one of his columns, which they used in an advertisement for the paper that they carried on a placard on the subway car. I happened to be riding on the subway car on the T, and I look at this advertising placard, and it's a quote from Ray Fitzgerald, the sports columnist, and it was something like, "I would give anything to be 3 years old, retired, and to have my entire sex life in front of me. Yes, I would give anything to be Secretariat." So, good line there from the great Ray Fitzgerald, a longtime sports columnist for the Boston Globe. But the And horses have always fascinated me. As I say, I haven't had much opportunity in my life. I've, you know, gone horseback riding a few, maybe half a dozen times total, and I'm far from super skilled at it. I also just have a kind of a fascination with the animal. What is it about horses that have so much appeal for people, do you think? A lot of folks just really are kind of fascinated by them.
Yeah. Well, people are like pets too, dogs and cats. But some people are attracted to horses. Well, young girls especially like them.
Yeah.
For whatever reason.
Yeah. That
you go to the stables anywhere and there's...
It seems to be a very common thing for girls in like that 7 to 10...
They get fascinated with them.
Age bracket.
Until the boys come along.
Yeah, maybe that's what it is. But I know I have nieces who went through their horse phase and, you know, their parents, I think, went out and got them horses or at least one horse and then, you know, they discover that you got to muck out the stalls and you got all the chores. Yeah, it's a lot of work to own a horse and to do it responsibly and so on. If somebody comes to you and says, you know, my 10-year-old daughter really wants me to get her a horse, what kind of advice do you give?
Well, first of all, it depends on the experience they have.
Yeah.
And they should, I've never been involved in saddle horses that much.
Yeah.
But talk to someone who knows what they're doing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And go to a stable and practice, basically.
Yeah. Actually, that's a good idea. Maybe take some horseback riding.
Don't just buy a horse and climb on because you're going to be in trouble.
Yeah, and it's probably a good idea to go to a stable, take some lessons, some horseback riding lessons. And usually, I think at most stables, as part of the lessons, you're going to be mucking out the stalls and actually, you know, dealing with some of the more, you know, the less fun aspects of the activity. So something to keep in mind there as a way to introduce folks to horseback riding. So your horses and the racing that you've done is it chariot racing? Is that the way to describe it?
Harness racing.
That's the word I'm looking for. There we go. Harness racing. And this is the, for folks who are even less familiar with all this than I am, I'm looking at a picture of harness racing right now, and there is a fella who is on a little, looks like a little wagon or almost.
Call them sulkies.
Kind of similar in some respects to a bicycle.
Well, actually, most people call them bikes in their business.
Oh, really?
Huh. Bike or a sulky.
A sulky, being pulled along by a horse. And I've never tried this. This is one thing. I've never sat in one of these things and been pulled by a horse. What's that like?
Well, you're up close and personal to those.
I would have thought so. You kind of, I mean, the horse's backside is right in your face pretty much, isn't it?
Pretty close.
Yeah, wow. Maybe
use a different kind of cart when we're just working out at home. We use what we call a jog cart. It's much longer and more narrow than that is.
I see. Okay, so you have a little more space between you and the horse.
And a padded seat.
And a padded seat. Yeah, I'm sure there are a lot of considerations like this that really come into play as people think about what is the setup I'm looking for. Now, this picture I'm looking at, which has the sulky quite close to the back of the horse, as I mentioned. I'm wondering, is that the standard thing that is used in harness racing?
They're all the same, yes.
Okay. So you wouldn't use the type of cart you were just describing in harness racing, would you? It was too far back.
I've got one of those when they're just working out at home for conditioning.
Yeah, okay.
It's what we call a jog cart.
A jog cart, okay. And that's good enough exercise to keep the horse in shape and so on.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. This is a beautiful looking horse. Which one is this? Do you know?
His name is there. Hickory Rockette.
Oh, right there. Okay, Hickory Rockette is the horse here. This is at the Saratoga Equine Sports Center Pacing Series Final. Now, was this one of yours or was this somebody else's?
Yes, I bought her in Pennsylvania.
Wow. Okay. What kind of horse is that?
She's a standard bred mare.
Okay. Uh huh. Is that the standard bred mares? Are those the horses that are standard in harness racing? Is that what everybody uses?
The name came about way back years ago. Most of the race horses then were, their bloodlines are from everywhere.
I see.
But they had to, in order to race at that time, I'm talking like the 1900s, early 1900s, they had to go at a certain speed, which they called a standard, before they could race for purse money.
Wow.
So they ended up being called standard breds.
And this is, I see a little note here attached that says, Hickory Roquette, Saratoga, Horse of the Year, 2001. She took on the boys and beat them all.
Right.
That's pretty cool. Wow. Are male horses typically faster than female horses or not?
Generally speaking, a little bit. But I remember that night she won that race.
She won that
race. My daughter brought her back. Patty brought her back to the paddock.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of young women involved in as grooms and so forth. And they're all lined up in the inside the paddock. Girl power, girl power, girl power.
All right. Wow, that must have been. Now, who's this in the sulky back here?
Oh, that's usually listed there. Danny Capello Jr.
Danny Capello Jr. Now, do you want to be a small person to ride in the do the harness racing, right? So the horse.
You can be any size, but actually, most of them are like 140, 150 pounds.
Yeah, yeah.
They aren't big men. Right. Most of them.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So you're not looking for an NFL linebacker or anything?
No, like you aren't looking for a big weight.
Yeah, I wouldn't think so. But the would you call yourself a regular at Saratoga? How many years? How many times a year do you get down there?
Oh, they race once a week. Each horse does.
Oh, wow. Okay.
When they're in shape.
So you're and how long is the season?
Well, actually, they start in March and go all the way to December, rather.
Huh.
Wow. But I don't attempt to do that. We have to travel.
Yeah, yeah.
We keep the horses at home.
Got it.
And transport them.
That is a lot. That would be quite a bit of gasoline and et cetera.
Well, it's not only that, but in bad weather, you don't want to be on the road with a trailer.
Yeah, that can be tough, too. Hey, we're going to take a bottom-of-the-hour break for some CBS News. A couple words from our sponsors. And when we return, we will be continuing our conversation about the horse industry in Vermont. Jim Harvey is my guest. Lives right across the river in Duxbury here. We'll be back in a few minutes, folks.
As the winter rolls on, we're on sale upstairs at the Warren Store. All fall winter clothing is 20 and 25% off. Cozy tops, comfy bottoms, warm coats and jackets for men and women. Cool, Prana, Smartwool, Save the Duck, Kari Tra long underwear. Need a hat? We have Skeeta, Shukas, Papia, and more. Palms and beanies galore. And a large selection of socks from fun to functional, blue Q to darn tough. Spring clothing is arriving, so come on down for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. The almost world-famous Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village.
Now back to the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM.
My guest is Jim Harvey, a longtime horseman here in the central Vermont area. Actually lives in Duxbury on the farm that's been in the family for 102 years, I'm told, and that's quite a record right there. And Mr. Harvey has been doing harness racing at Saratoga for how many years have you done that, Jim?
Oh, at least 40.
At least 40 years as a harness racer. And you have a horse who's now, I guess, retired. Kelly's Noah actually is in the Harness Racing Hall of Fame at Saratoga. Is that right?
That's right, yes.
That's quite an honor. It must be. When was Kelly's Noah inducted into the Hall of Fame down there?
It was about 4 years ago now.
Hmm. And did the whole family go down for the celebration and so on?
Some of them did, not a lot of them.
Uh-huh. And is there... do you get into some kind of a parade or whatever?
No, it's just a ceremony.
I see.
And they give you a plaque and that sort of thing, and trophies, and then the plaque is mounted on the wall of the museum.
And speaking of halls of fame, you are actually you yourself are not just your horse, but you, Jim Harvey himself, is in the Vermont Agriculture Hall of Fame. Is that right?
That's right. Yes.
And that's quite an honor as well. When did that happen?
About 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm. And so you, this is This is big stuff here, folks. 244-1777 is the local number here in Waterbury for you to call in and check us out and ask this veteran horseman, Jim Harvey of Duxbury, 89 years old. He's been around horses his whole life, and he is here to answer any questions you might have. What would you say, Jim, just about the overall evolution of horse racing in Vermont? Is it a growing thing or is it shrinking?
No, it's shrinking with the fairs. There used to be Essex Junction, Lindenville, Barton, Rutland, Tunbridge, and there's only two left now, Barton and Tunbridge.
Oh, really, huh? Those are the only fairs that do harness racing now?
Yeah, they're the only two left.
Wow. And do you participate at both?
Once in a great while, but not very often. Generally at the raceways.
I see.
Purse structure is so much greater.
Which track do you like better, Barton or Tunbridge?
Barton has they rebuilt the surface, so it's top shelf for a county fair track. Surface.
What do you want for a surface for these animals?
Up there, they put stone dust over dirt.
Hmm. And that packs down really well, I would gather.
Packed down really well.
Uh huh.
It's easy to maintain.
And is that something that the horses like to run on in terms of their own comfort and so on?
Yeah, as long as it's a smooth surface and they can get a good grip on it.
Hmm. Yeah, I would gather that would be and you'd want a smooth surface if you're riding in the sulky behind there too.
Right. Especially no springs on a sulky.
Especially if you don't have a padded seat, you could be in for a rough time if you were hitting a lot of bumps back there.
Well, actually, the seat does have some padding, but there's no springs under them.
Yeah, wow.
Chug cart there is.
Yeah. Boom, boom, boom. But that is something. Now, are you someone who, you obviously have been trading horses and sort of sponsoring horses and owning horses, which have appeared in harness races. Have you spent much time in a sulky yourself?
Early on, I drove at Saratoga and Montreal, but as I got older, I put the young guys down there. And not only that, but in the driving colony, most tracks is about 12 guys that drive all of them.
I see, okay.
And they know each other and the tendencies of each other, and they have a better idea what's going on around them.
Now, in the races themselves, I'm just curious as sort of the structure of how this sporting event works. Do you get out there and you're racing against how many other horses and harnesses?
Generally speaking, there's a field of eight.
A field of eight. Wow, that could be fairly crowded. And is there a lot of bumping and sort of cutting each other off and stuff?
No, they start behind the starting. You familiar with the starting gate?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Well, anyway, each horse is allotted 8 feet.
Okay, well, once you're out there on the track and you're actually racing against each other, is there any of that sort of the goings on there where you're kind of?
They frown on it pretty much. Okay. It's so dangerous.
Yeah,
bumping and running and that sort of thing.
Somebody could get hurt, a person or an animal in that case. And
so, there's been some bad accidents.
Yeah, you want to be careful about that, and. Speaking of which, out in California, I guess there have been a number of problems at racetracks and so on in recent times. Has that hurt the industry and the overall sort of image?
Well, that's basically a thoroughbred problem.
Yeah. You're not seeing this in harness racing at all?
No. I've never seen a horse have a broken leg in harness racing.
Wow. Okay. Well, that's good to know. Hey, we do have a caller on the line. Let's go to Brian from Washington. Good morning, Brian.
Hi. How are you?
Good. Doing well. How are you?
Good. Just a couple of questions for Mr. Harvey there. I was wondering if he was racing back in the 70s, the 60s and 70s.
You were racing back in the 60s and 70s, right?
Yes. I started out in 68.
In 1968?
Yep.
Yeah. My father was racing in 1968, also down there. We were stabled right at Saratoga. We stayed right at the track.
Wow.
Yes. Actually, we were there for 9 years. 1969, he was picked Horseman of the Year at Saratoga.
And are you a horseman yourself, Brian?
No. I've been out of it since I was 20 years old.
What causes people to get out of it, would you say?
Commitment, 7 days a week.
Yeah. It is a lot of work to keep a horse in, and certainly if you're going to keep it in racing shape, right?
Yes, yeah. Yes, it is. My father used to carry about 17, 18 horses.
Wow. Yeah. And did he have another job aside from that?
No.
So he's just a full-time horse person?
Correct, yes. Yeah. I was wondering there if he remembers people like Harold Story, Harold Parker.
You remember Harold? I drove horses against him.
Exactly.
That
yeah.
was an experience.
Harold Parker, too.
I'm sorry?
Parker. His last name was Parker. Harold Parker, I believe it was.
A little bit, yes. I knew him, yeah.
Yeah. My father was Harold White. You probably raced.
I'm sorry, I don't hear very well with this here.
My father was Harold White. You probably raced against him also.
A lot of Harolds in this sport.
Yes, there was.
what was the last name?
Harold White.
In 1969, my father had a horse named Francis T. Leary. Would you remember that one by any chance?
Yeah, I remember. I think I. Were there two Harold Whites?
No.
I knew who you're talking about then. Because I thought there was one from Northern New York, which I raced county fairs in New York State.
No.
And there's a Harold White there quite often.
No, he never raced over there. Actually, he raced from Saratoga. We went down to Bay State Raceway, which was in Foxborough, Mass.
Oh, is that right?
Hmm.
And then, I'm mistaken. This was a long time ago.
Yes. Oh, yeah. You're speaking early 70s. all through like 65 through 72, I think it was, that we raced at Saratoga. 72 or 74 it was when we left Saratoga.
I didn't really race much at Saratoga until after that. Early on, I started the county fairs, and then they went to Hinsdale Raceway in New Hampshire.
Yeah, Hinsdale,
for several years. And
you remember, what was his name? I can't think of it now because it's so long ago.
That's okay.
So many years ago.
Well, Brian, it sounds like you do have quite a history here. And any other members of your family continuing the horse tradition?
No, they did not, no.
I see.
Like I say, it was such a commitment. You know, it's 7 days a week, have to clean the stalls twice a day.
Yep.
You know, you got to keep them in immaculate shape.
I heard if you're really good at that, sometimes call you a stable genius.
Yeah. Well, no, I just wanted to bring it up and say, you know, it's great to hear that, you know, a fellow like you still, you know, like to enjoy talking about it. And you find very far and few now that do remember this type of, you know, back in the years, definitely harness racing is on its way out, I believe. It's nowhere near as popular as it was.
Do you think that's okay, Brian, or would you rather see it preserved?
I'd like to see it preserved. You know, I go, actually, I travel down to Saratoga quite often just to watch the harness racing.
Yeah, it's exciting stuff, so there you go.
Oh,
hey,
yeah.
Brian, thank you very much for the call. Appreciate your insights and thoughts about all this, so that's great.
Have a great day.
You too. So, Jim Harvey, I'm wondering if you, your experiences as a horseman and as someone going to Saratoga, did you go to Saratoga pretty much every week, did you say?
Once they get racing, they usually race once a week, yes.
Wow. I'm thinking that's a four-hour trip each way, right?
Three-hour travel time.
Three-hour travel time, okay. As Brian was just talking about the commitment, what kept you in it for so long?
Oh, we've done pretty well. This Kelly's Nose, as I say, has won more money than any horse ever raised in Vermont.
Mm-hmm.
So,
did you?
It's not much fun doing it for nothing.
Yeah, I can imagine you would want to make some money if you can. Would you say that this it has been your major source of income, or was the dairy farm bigger for a long time?
No, I've always had a job or been doing something on the farm,
mm-hmm.
and this has been a sideline.
I see. Okay. So, there's some expenses, too, though, obviously, keeping the animals and keeping them fed and that sort of thing.
There's a lot of expense involved between the farriers and the veterinarians and buying the feed and doing all the work to get the hay in and so on.
But there's a. I'm sure your tax accountant must have fun with all that, adding up the feed and the vet bills and all the rest of it. Got some serious business expenses there, I would think. But it sounds to me like it's There's part of it anyway. That's kind of a labor of love, right? I mean,
oh, to agree. Yeah, you have to like what you're doing.
Yeah,
same as any job you're doing.
I would think so for sure. And tell me about the scene in Vermont. How many harness racers are still doing it in Vermont right now?
Well, I don't know of too many. Most of them are from Bennington area, and they race in Saratoga.
Mm-hmm.
But most of those fellows have moved to Saratoga for all the transporting back and forth.
Yeah, so yeah.
So there aren't really very many left in the state.
I see. Okay.
But there are a few.
Yep. Well, hey, we do have another caller checking in with us. Let's go to Forbes in Corinth. Good morning, Forbes.
Hey, how are you?
Doing well. How are you?
A little history here. My dad had a horse. He raced in Maine at Scarborough Downs.
Mm-hmm.
And actually today, if it wasn't for harness racing, we wouldn't have a fair. Fairs were an excuse for a horse race.
Yeah.
And that's where it basically started. And so that's a lot of history there.
Wow. So your dad would go to the Scarborough Fair over in Maine.
Right. Well, Scarborough Downs was a racetrack in outside of Portland, Maine.
I see. Okay.
And he had a stall there with horses there.
Mm-hmm. And was that harness racing also, or?
Yes.
Right. And did you ever participate yourself?
No, I never. I've owned horses most of my life, but never harness racing. That's a kind of a unique system.
And I'm sure it takes a fair amount of investment in the animals and the equipment and, you know, the sulky, et cetera.
Yeah, it was a big investment. Lucky he had a business that could support it, but mm-hmm. a labor of love, really.
Yeah, and it's probably a little bit something like, I've known people who just love their sailboats. They get out there and they do yachting or whatever, and others are skeptical. I remember someone I'm close to once described yachting as something like taking a shower and just shoving $100 bills down the drain while you're in there.
Kind of a sinking fund.
So, I don't know. Did you ever have any similar skepticism, Jim Harvey, about what you were doing with these horses, or has it pretty much always been a winner for you?
Okay.
Yeah, Jim Harvey, my guest here, I'm asking you, you know, did you ever sort of stop and ask yourself, is this really smart? Should I be doing this? Or was it pretty much always a winning proposition for you?
All in all, it's worked out pretty well, yeah.
Wow, that's
early on, I developed young horses and sold them.
Forbes,
they didn't travel very much.
And our caller, Forbes, let me ask you, did you ever, your dad was the one who was a harness racing enthusiast, right?
Right. Yeah.
And did you ever have any thoughts like maybe I should do that too?
Well, no, actually the system itself, the jockeys, the ones that actually race, they're kind of a unique group by themselves.
Mm-hmm.
You just don't put anybody into a sulky.
Yeah.
They ride for or drive for several people usually.
And I'm wondering about the training that goes into that. That must be, what do you have to do to become a harness racing driver? Jim Harvey, what do you know about that?
Early on, you have to be recommended by a half a dozen different people.
I see.
Written. And then you take a written test.
Hmm.
And you drive in qualifying races and that sort of thing.
Is there an association that sort of issues the test?
Yes, the United States Trotting Association.
United States Trotting Association.
They regulate everything and it has to do with this.
Okay, I see. And how many harness racing tracks are there around the country now, though, that you know?
Well, New York has Yonkers, Saratoga, Buffalo, Tioga Downs.
So a few of them right in New York State.
They have five in New York.
Uh-huh.
Montreal is closed down.
They closed it down in Montreal?
Yeah.
Wow. Jim, I just, it fascinates me to think that here's a gentleman right here in our neighborhood, Waterbury, Duxbury, oftentimes sort of feel like one community here, and here is someone who's really made quite a quite a name for himself in this field. And I was starting to ask you before the break, are there others in Vermont who are in a similar league as you, or would you say you're pretty unique?
Some of those fellows race to Saratoga, and they do well.
Uh-huh.
And training and driving.
Yeah.
And most of them have moved from the Bennington area to
closer Saratoga. To Saratoga. How far is Bennington from Saratoga? Do you know?
Actually, I don't think it's all that far. Probably mm-hmm. half, three quarter of an hour, maybe.
Oh, I see. So that's not, it's not like going from Duxbury all the way down to Saratoga.
No.
That's a, did you ever think about moving down to Saratoga or down to somewhere closer?
No, I've never moved away from home.
Yep. Wanted to stay right here in good old Duxbury. And so you're, Your own family now, you see your kids, are they going to continue this for the next generations in terms of the harness racing at Saratoga and so on?
I would rather doubt it.
Does that make you sad? Do you wish they would?
They're involved in their own world.
Yeah. It's a different world these days, too. There's a lot of stuff going on. And in many, many cases, I remember you mentioning you had eight kids and back in your day, now did your wife work or?
No, when the children were young, she
yeah.
She was.
I'm sure she worked on the farm quite a bit, but
no, she didn't work on the. She raised a family.
Oh, okay. Uh huh. And
she was a music teacher in secondary schools.
Oh wow. Okay.
When we were married.
I see. Okay, and so she had a career that was outside of the whole horse racing thing.
Right.
What did she think about you taking off every weekend for Saratoga? Yeah. Would she go with you?
Sometimes she went.
Yep. And, I mean, was she excited about it, or do you feel like you kind of dragged her along?
As long as the horses do well, she doesn't worry about it, or didn't.
Yeah. Wow, that's that is quite a lot of commitment on the part of the whole family, really, when you're doing
that's
this.
That's right.
Yeah. Wow, and I was looking at the at a story that 7 Days did several years ago, actually now, about your work with Kelly's Noah, this prize-winning horse of yours, and I see his best winning time was about 151. The best track record at Saratoga ever was 150, so that was pretty close.
He was near the top.
The best ever, and did you? It must have been a challenge for you to say, can I get a horse that's even faster than Kelly's Noah? Have you ever had any candidates?
No, he's been the top horse.
I get it. Okay. Hey, just a few minutes to go here. Let's go to Sue in Randolph. Good morning, Sue.
Hi. I just had a question for your guest mm-hmm. regarding trotters and pacers, what his horses were and what the difference is between the harness horses, the trotters, and the pacers.
Can you tell us the answer, the question rather is, were your horses trotters or pacers, and is there a difference between the two?
I've had both, actually, and these pacers, they travel with their legs on the same side going forward at the same time.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And
wow.
The trotters, left front, right rear, go forward, and then right front, left rear. They're diagonally gated, we call it.
So
whereas the pacer is laterally gated. He goes forward.
So it kind of depends on in what order they put their hooves down, right?
Yes. Do they race together?
You see the bobbles here.
Do they race together, the trotters and pacers?
No, very. Once in a great while at a county fair, but not at a raceway.
Okay, yeah.
Okay, thank you very much.
Interesting questions. Thanks for the call. Appreciate it. We are fast approaching the top of the hour here. My guest is Jim Harvey. He is a harness horse racer, harness racing enthusiast and participant, and owner of a horse that actually is in the Hall of Fame over at the Saratoga Raceway in New York State. So we have a big league athlete, I guess I'd say, in our studio this morning. I'm proud to say here on the Dave Graham Show, and Once again, I just find it fascinating that a lot of people live in our community who have really special and interesting contributions they've made to the world, and I'd love to hear about them, folks. Anybody want to nominate a neighbor to come on the show and talk about what they've done and what they've been up to, just drop me a line at dgram, at radiovermont.com, and I'll have a look at it and see if we can figure out a way to get your friend, neighbor, family member, whoever it is, or yourself, for that matter, on our radio show here on WDEV FM and AM. We are fast approaching, as I mentioned, the top of the hour. I want to thank my guest, Jim Harvey of Duxbury, very much for stopping by this morning. Thank you so much, Jim.
You're welcome.
And that's going to about do it for this edition of the Dave Graham Show on this Tuesday morning. We'll be back tomorrow. We're going to be talking about, I know one segment we've got coming tomorrow is going to be about the coronavirus. So anybody want to hear about that, tune in tomorrow. And meanwhile, have a great day, everybody. Stay tuned now for Bill Sarah, Common Sense Radio.